الله أكبر الله أكبر الله
In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the Creator and the Sustainer of the Universe, peace and blessings upon His Messenger and Servant, Muhammad, forever. Amin. I bear witness that there is no deity worthy of worship except for the one God, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the Messenger and Slave Servant of God. To all of the viewers of the Islam in Focus program, I greet you with the universal greetings of peace, the greeting that has been used by all the prophets from Abraham to Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. This is the Islam in Focus program. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. In today's program, we start our seventh in the series dealing with the pillars of Islam. And today we'll be talking about the third pillar of Islam, which is zakat, or roughly translated in English as charity. Joining me on the program is Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Jamal.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
I'd like to go to the meaning of the term zakat. I mentioned in my opening remarks that that could be roughly translated as being charity, but oftentimes when you read books that have been written by many people who are non-Muslims, there's different translations and different meanings that are assigned to this term, zakat. Sometimes, for example, they indicate that it's like a tithe, which would be familiar to many of our viewers, I'm sure. Some suggest that it's a tax. Some say it's a religious tax. Some say that it's some say charity and so on. Are any of these words roughly equivalent to the term zakat? Or equivalent to the term zakat?
Well, quite frankly, none of these terms really fully explains the original Islamic term zakat. I don't know of any language that has the exact equivalent to this. The original or literal meaning of zakat in Arabic means purity. Purity. For example, we find that in the Quran in chapter 9, verse 103, addressing the Prophet says, take from their property something to purify them and to sanctify them. This is the origin of the word. Some other related meaning also in Arabic to the term zakah means also blessing or growth and development. Of course, blessing, growth and development are also related to purification through the act of payment of zakah. In the legislative sense, in terms of Islamic jurisprudence, zakah simply means the payment of a certain percentage of one's assets to the rightful beneficiaries as an act of love of God and expression of obedience and gratefulness to Him. Well, in this basic sense I explained, then, the terms that you refer to, some are quite erroneous, some are incomplete. An erroneous term that I'm familiar, like you mentioned, is mentioned quite frequently, tithe. It is not equivalent to tithe, because tithe, if you look into the dictionary definition, is the one-tenth of the produce of the land which is paid, especially in medieval times, to support the church and clergy. Whereas in Islam, zakah is not paid to support clergy or church, it's paid to support the poor. And in Islam also, you know that there is no institution of church as is understood in the, you know, Judeo-Christian tradition. The term tax is not appropriate either, because when you say tax, most people think of something that you've got to pay because you've got to, or else you'll be punished by law if you don't pay it. When you pay tax, you pay it also reluctantly. You try to seek every deduction that you could possibly get. You could try your best to avoid payment of tax whenever it's legal by claiming anything that you can. In the case of zakah. It is done essentially by the Muslim as an act of worship and love of God. So you don't do it reluctantly, you do it enthusiastically.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, in zakah also is different from tax, because zakah is determined by way of minimum, and the Muslim is encouraged and induced to pay more than that minimum.
Mm-hmm.
You never hear of that in tax. For example, if your tax return shows that you've got to pay $3,000, you don't say, all right, let me pay
$3,500. Yes.
You never heard of that.
No.
But in Islamic...
I heard the other way around. Someone said, $100, but not more.
Right. But in Islamic attitude of paying zakah as a worship of God, as an obedience, gratefulness to Him, many people actually pay more than that. So in that sense, then, I would say that perhaps the term you used earlier, charity,
mm-hmm.
or alms, maybe charity is the closest meaning to expressing the meaning of zakah. Because if you check, for example, in Webster's dictionary, it says that charity means an act of love of God or fellow human beings. So it actually combines both of them, maybe with just one reservation. Most people, when you say charity, it gives the sense of something voluntary. You pay it or you don't pay it. It's all left up to you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Islam, zakah is an obligatory duty on every Muslim. There is a minimum, but of course there is no maximum to what you could possibly pay. So I'd say perhaps charity is the closest meaning to that.
Mm-hmm. We always encounter difficulty when we try to translate things into language perhaps. So that's
right.
Not the original. I'd like to ask you about the significance and the place of zakat among the pillars that we've been discussing and will discuss in the programs to come. It comes third. We've talked about the first two principles. It comes third. Does it follow that it's the third most
right.
important
yeah.
one of these?
The way I interpret it, right, yeah, among the five pillars of Islam, after the testimony, the prayers, comes always zakat. And this is confirmed further in the Quran. When we find that zakah or charity has been combined or mentioned side by side with prayers in more than 80 verses, 80. Mm-hmm. Just to give you one example, in chapter 24, verse 56, it says, "So establish regular prayer and give regular charity and obey the messenger that you may receive mercy." The Quran also indicates that failure to pay this duty of charity towards fellow needy human beings earns the person the wrath and punishment of God in this life and in the hereafter. And this life could be the loss of blessings, suffering, and as well as the punishment in the hereafter. For example, in chapter 9 in the Quran, in verse 34, you find a very dramatic description of how people who are reluctant to pay zakah are punished in the Day of Judgment. It says that those who hoard gold and silver and spend it not in the way of God announce unto them a most grievous penalty. And then it goes on to describe that this metal that they used to cherish
mm-hmm.
will be heated, and then they will be marked or branded in their faces and their backs and their flanks. So it really gives a very terrible description
mm-hmm.
of the consequences of this miserliness and lack of gratefulness to God. On the other side, you find also the Quran is replete with quotations which encourages people to do this act of charity or zakah. Just to give you one or two examples, in the chapter 2 in the Quran, particularly verse 261 and on, it gives a vivid description as to how God rewards people manifolds of what they spend by way of charity.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to this. The parable of those who spend of their sustenance or wealth in the way of God is like that of a grain of corn. It grows 7 ears, and each ear has 100 grains. God gives manifold or multiply rewards, increase to whom He pleases, and God cares for all, and He knows all things. So even one act of charity, you spend $1, God can reward you even 700 times as much as you have spent. And He even says, and more.
Mm-hmm.
This is one. In describing the believers also in the Day of Judgment by way of their reward in paradise, for example, in chapter 51 from verses 15 on, it gives a vivid description of the enjoyment and felicity of believers. And then it relates to the reasons, one of which is the regular payment of zakah. Let me recite that to you. As to the righteous, they will be in the midst of gardens and springs, taking joy in the things which their Lord gives unto them. Because before then, that's before the Day of Judgment, or while they're living on earth, they lived a good life, a righteous life. They were in a habit of sleeping but little at night because they spent part of it in worship. And in the hours of the early dawn, they were found praying for forgiveness. And, this is the part, in their wealth and possessions was remembered the right of the needy who asked, or those even who didn't ask. So in that sense then, above all, the payment of zakah or charity is an act of love of God, is an act of expression of the commitment or covenant to obey God and submit to His directions.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the, to get you to elaborate a little bit, when we were talking about the meaning, you said that zakah literally means purity. What do you mean? Could you explain what you mean when you say it literally means purity?
It means that when you pay zakah, it purifies, and purifies a number of meanings.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, it purifies your property or your assets. Because if this is a duty on you to pay, then it is not pure unless you pay what is due on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it purifies your property, it makes it more blessed or legitimate or valid in the spiritual sense. Okay? Secondly, it purifies the heart of he or she who gives zakah, purify the heart from selfishness, greed, materialism,
mm-hmm.
lack of concern for fellow human beings. So that's another meaning also of purification. It also purifies the heart of the recipient of zakah, the poor.
Mm-hmm.
Purify his heart from jealousy, from hatred against those who possess more and don't care for him. So by this kind of sharing, the act of love and sharing and mutual concern, humanitarian feelings, his heart also is purified from jealousy. You can look at it even in a social level. And you can say also zakah is purification of society at large, from class struggle and conflict, purification of society from social injustices, the system of economics or politics which allows the rich to become richer and the poor to become poorer, almost like taxing the poor to pay the rich, all kinds of things. As an example of this, a medical doctor, for example, can deduct the transportation cost of his car and depreciation as part of his business expense. But poor you and me cannot do it, even though many people who are not earning as much are in more need to have this kind of deduction.
Some can't even afford to buy the car.
Exactly. Right. So this is one aspect, to purify society from this kind of feelings of injustices and lack of concern for others. It purifies society as a result of this from any subversive ideology which find fertile ground when you have this kind of greed and lack of social justice in the system of economics or social system in general.
Mm-hmm. You've touched lightly on this, the Islamic view of private ownership. I'm sure that this would be something that would be of interest to many of the people who are watching the program. Could you explain this view perhaps a little more, at least as it relates to the concept of the zakat that we're talking about?
In other words, you're referring to the social justice that I mentioned as it relates to how Islam views property.
Right.
Right. Well, to start with, Islam makes it clear, and we find abundant evidence of that in the Quran, that above all, all the universe, with all what it contains, belongs ultimately and exclusively to God. That is, God is the absolute sovereign owner and master of the universe. From this basic notion, it follows then that no human being, nobody, owns anything in the absolute and ultimate sense.
Mm-hmm.
According to the Quran, human beings are created to be the trustees of God on earth, to fulfill His will. It means then that God, out of His benevolence, even though he owns everything, has endowed us with these resources or this wealth to test us, to give it as a trust in our hands so that to see whether we can use this capability or wealth in the way that pleases him to serve ourselves, our families, and humanity at large. But in that sense, then, you find that the Quran sometimes talk about property as the domain or ownership of God. For example, in chapter 57, verse 6 says that those who believe in God and His Messenger and spend in charity out of the sustenance whereof He has made you heirs and trustees. He has given you. You don't really own it as such. But you find, however, that out of the grace of God, still we find in the Quran He uses the term your property, your wealth, to refer to human beings, in order to give us the same sense of dignity, to give us a sense of confidence in ourselves, to encourage us and motivate us. And it is natural, instinctive nature in all human beings that they want to work and get some reward for that work. They want to accumulate some kind of wealth. So the Quran also, on the other hand, uses the term your property. We find that, for example, in chapter 2, verses 262, and also in 188, in the same chapter. But something that's really fascinating in the Quran, that even though God owns everything, when He asks us or command us to spend part of that for the needy, He calls that a loan. Imagine, He owns everything, and then when we pay, He considers it like a loan from us to Him. Of course, not in the literal sense. God doesn't need loans from anyone. Yeah. You don't borrow what you own. But it just gives us this sweet feeling that we are dealing not just with human beings, not with government or tax collectors. We're dealing with God Himself, who is abundantly generous in terms of His reward. Just to give you one quotation of this, to give the sense of it. In chapter 2, in verse 245, it says, "Who is he or she that will loan to God a beautiful loan, which God will double unto his credit and multiply many times?" And what could be a better deal than this? As we mentioned before, in the same chapter, chapter 2, it talks about multiplying 7 times, 700 times, or more. So this reflects the attitude of the Muslim, that neither does Islam condemn private ownership, nor does it tolerate greedy type of economic systems that crushes the poor and needy and just keep the rich richer and the poor poorer, or at least stationary.
It's a very beautiful concept, the concept of being a trustee.
Right.
I think if people could keep that foremost in their minds, it might have a very profound impact in terms of how our relationship and some of the economic systems that are prevalent.
A sense of social responsibility.
Right, indeed. I'd like to ask you a series of short questions now relating to the system of zakat and its rules. I guess the one that would obviously come to most people's mind is who has to pay it. Here we talk about taxes. Everybody must pay the taxes if we're a wage earner and so on. What about zakat? Who has to pay zakat?
Okay, zakat is due on every Muslim who owns something beyond his basic needs for a year, amounting to what is called nisab or more. Nisab was simply a minimum of extra beyond which a person is not required really to pay zakat. This nisab or minimum varies from time to time. It is estimated at the present time roughly between, let's say, $400 and $500. In other words, if you're a Muslim, you have something beyond your basic needs amounting to $400 or more, and you have that already for a year or more, then zakah is due on this extra, whichever. The extra or assets in general that you may possess.
Now, when you say zakah is paid on one's assets, now does that mean that all of the assets that you own, for example, your house, would be taken into this calculation as well?
No, there are exemptions, just like we talk also about deductions, legitimate deductions. Of course, first of all, you don't pay zakah on your basic needs, as I mentioned before, when you have like clothing at home or food that you're storing, you don't have to pay zakat on that because these are basic needs. That's exempt. Secondly, your principal residence is also not zakatable. You don't have to pay zakat. That's, of course, possible term. It's not zakatable. The tools of profession also is exempt from zakat because this is not wealth. This is a tool to help you earn money. Suppose you're a carpenter or whatever, and you have equipment, you know, craftsmen, that this is exempt. Some jurists also make analogy to that with the machinery. If you have a factory, you don't pay zakat on machinery if the machinery are used not to buy and sell, but machinery to produce goods and services. So this is also exempt. For women, their jewelry, particularly like, you know, gold, silver, others, is not also zakatable to the amount that is acceptable as a good norm or a reasonable norm for personal use, for adornment. But if those jewelry are used as saving, a method of saving, then it could be, or that amount would be zakatable. But if it's just for personal use, a reasonable amount, that's not subject to zakat. So this is, it doesn't mean that all assets, that everything from your garment to... Yeah.
More or less in the jargon of the day, you might say the luxuries, what we would consider to be luxuries over and above what would be our basic needs.
Right. Actually, like some jurists divided, they say it's, zakat is due in terms of assets in basically four categories. One is the produce, that's the produce of the land. Secondly, it's due also on cattle, and there is a whole detailed system, what kind of cattle, the age and so on, and how much you pay out of each. It is also due on so-called articles of trade, like the inventory, let's say, that you buying and selling in a year. And also on gold and silver. This has been a classic classification that you find in jurisprudence book. But of course today, instead of using gold and silver as coins, we are using money. So again, the same analogy applies to property that you have by way of money, like cash, savings in the bank, or even stocks that you buy, because that also could be analogous either to a saving or to a sort of investment which would fall under zakat on articles of trade.
What about the amount of zakat required now?
It varies. You know, there's a big body of literature detailing all these issues. But to give it in a very brief and summary way, it ranges anywhere between 2.5% to 20% maximum. And that varies with the type of asset and the difficulty with which you acquire this asset. So there's a built-in system of equity and justice. Example. For money, for example, or saving, or gold or silver, it's 2.5%. Okay? On land or produce of land, it is 10% if the land is irrigated only by rain, so you're not spending so much investment or effort on that. It is 5% if you're using equipment, you know, to irrigate.
Irrigation equipment.
Like motors and all that. Pumps.
Motors and so on.
Some jurists also said that if it is irrigated combined a little bit by machinery and a little bit by rain, then it could be 7.5%. Some jurists even added that if it is just if it's using equipment and lots of effort and lots of expenditure that you have to put in, then it comes 2.5%. So it varies anywhere between 2.5% to 10%, depending on, again, the method. On treasure, suppose you walk the next day in some island and discover a treasure or something, or mine, without much effort. If you just face it like that without much expenditure, then you pay 20% out of that. So it varies, like I said, but the most common, of course, is the 20% in the most common wealth that most people look at in terms of cash value.
We shouldn't be really carrying along a parallel between the taxes that we normally are familiar with in zakat, but here, for example, we know that, I think it's March 31st is the magic day when we must pay IRS or the national revenue, or else. So what about zakat? Is there any particular time when zakat has to be paid?
Okay, the most common rule is that it should be paid at the end of every year. But there are exceptions to that. If, for example, the treasure that if you find a treasure,
mm-hmm.
the treasure of mine,
mm-hmm.
then zakah on this would be due immediately after you find it, because you haven't spent much effort.
Mm-hmm.
It's due immediately. On produce of land, the due date is the date of harvest, which is fair,
mm-hmm.
because you don't pay it before the harvest is ripe, and it might not really turn out to be good harvest.
Mm-hmm.
So you pay it when it's ripe and ready.
Mm-hmm.
In all other cases, you pay it at least once a year. So you find out how much did you have beyond your basic needs for a year, and then you pay zakah on that. It is recommended, however, to pay zakah during the month of Ramadan, the month of fasting, because this
mm-hmm.
is a month where charity would be rewarded manifold.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, if you decide not to wait until the end of the year and you want to pay in installments over the year, subject to final adjustment at the end of the year, that also would be acceptable. So basically, it's running. And there's a good wisdom behind that. If zakah is paid every week or every month, it becomes quite cumbersome to those who
mm-hmm.
Pay it. If it becomes too long, then it becomes too hard on people who need to receive this zakah. So there's also a balance of the needs of individual and society.
This brings us into the next area. Who is entitled to receive this zakah?
This is specified in the Quran. There are 8 categories in chapter 9, verse 60 in the Quran, which includes, first, the poor, second, miskeen, which means needy, who do not ask people, who are so dignified they don't even want to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Third could be the employees appointed by the government to collect zakah, if need be.
Mm-hmm.
Fourthly, people who embraced Islam recently and have some difficulty settling until they... Or also, by the same token, to prevent harm being done to Muslims. The fifth category, to free slaves or prisoners of wars by way of ransom. Sixth, for those who are in debt as a result of disaster, but not just squandering money on illegitimate means of expenditure.
Mm-hmm.
Seventh, in the way of God, which is an open... either for defense or in propagation of the faith or bringing its message to others in terms of education. And the final or eighth category in that chapter is the wayfarer who are stranded in foreign lands and don't have what is sufficient for them. And of course, it is recommended to give people who are in more need and to start first by your own township or environment, going gradually out. Of course, for those who are living in places where there is a large degree of affluence, many jurists said that they could send or transport this amount of charity to places where it is most needed, like places where there are lots of famines in the world today,
mm-hmm.
and there are a lot more deserving than what you might find in an immediate vicinity, then you could do that also.
Mm-hmm. Well, just before we close off this program dealing with zakat, there's an interesting... hadith that we were chatting about before we started today's program, for those people perhaps who may not be in a position to be able to make a monetary or some other payment of zakat. I wonder if perhaps you just might share that saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, about an act of charity.
About what you should really...
About the spouse.
Oh, yes. Actually, the word sadaqah, which is used also for zakat in the monetary sense,
right.
He says that when you smile in your brother's face, this is charity. When you ordain the good and forbid the evil, that's charity. When you remove something from the way of people that might hurt them, that's charity. When you help someone who is looking for a place and getting lost, that's charity. When you help someone who is blind or has bad sight, that is charity. When you give out of the water that you have in your bucket and put in your brother's bucket, this is also an act of charity. So it's much more than just money.
Much more than just money. Well, thank you, Brother Jamal, for doing this program. We've exhausted our time for today. We want to invite you back to the Islam in Focus program next week when we'll start another pillar on Islam. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum.
Allahu Akbar.